Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance.
Each night we're going to bring the best. That Radio Susie just fell off her chair. I can say that, not even three times. We'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast, and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
And to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet. Not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't.
Oh, it's time for tips from the publishing guru, Todd Rutherford, back with his founder of the AskThePublishingGuru.com. And as a consultant, he's been involved with the writing, publishing, and marketing of more than 2,500 different books and counting. Hey, Todd, welcome back.
Great to be here, Michael. I always love your choice of music as I'm waiting to come on to speak with you.
Isn't that fun stuff?
Yes, even though I'm younger, just a little bit younger than you are, I really enjoy it.
When you said a little bit younger, both you and Radio Susie fell off your chairs. But I love you both. I love you both. Okay. Now, I have a question. When we get into, and by the way, I am glad I got as far as I've got, and I've got more time to go. But I want to talk about this for a moment. The making a blog work for you. There's so many people who had no idea what a blog was 3-4 years ago. Todd, all of a sudden, blogs just blew up. What actually is a blog? And let's work from there.
Well, a blog is basically just a website that you can post something to daily as the writer. You control this, and it started out by being called a web log, and it was just an online journal, basically, where you could just, every day you could write something for the day, and this would be something that I want to basically share with the world. And so, just like you have for instance, if you're a writer and you were trying to get syndicated in a newspaper where every week you would have a column in that newspaper, and a blog is basically an online version of that column. You have the opportunity to post something every day, every hour, every minute.
Yeah.
You could, as often as you want to, you can post something on that blog, and then you can begin to promote that blog to try to develop subscribers who actually listen to it and read it on a weekly or daily basis, depending how often, how frequently you post something to your blog.
That's an interesting one. How often or frequently you post to the blog. Let's say, for instance, that you have a particular topic. You're blogging, and then where do you go for more information? When I say more information, what about that frequently updating? How many times does an author run out of something to say about their particular topic?
I recommend, especially for those who are just starting out with blogging, to just start out to blog just once a week. This starts you out as a regular contributor, and it gets you on a consistent schedule. And then as you can always add maybe another day during the week. And, one suggestion to help keeping you updating your blog is to pick a topic or theme for the month and then write various different posts or subtopics on that main topic or theme throughout the month. And it's also important that, blogging is not stressful or you won't keep doing it. And the whole purpose of blogging, especially like as an author or even as a small business owner or something to blog, the purpose is to develop a following of people that are seeing you as an expert on your topic. And then if you have a product or service to sell, hopefully they'll end up buying it because you've branded yourself as an expert on your topic or subject matter or genre. And so, you know, even if it's once a month, write one really great article and people will look forward to it. If you use the scheduling power of your blogging software, you can get a week or two ahead as well, because you can actually write maybe four or five blog posts at a time. As far as the length of blog posts, too, you don't have to worry about it being something extremely long. Usually, you know, a couple hundred to 300, maybe a maximum of 500 words is more than sufficient. But it's very common to see a 200 or 300-word blog post that's just, you know, based on a topic and you write about it. So,
Todd, how many pages is that?
Well, a single 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper will typically have, if it's double-spaced, it'll have about 300 words on it. If it's single-spaced, it'll have about 500. So you're really talking about, you know, half a page to a full page on an 8.5 by 11 sheet.
Okay, now how does that equate to, as in, let's say, Word on a computer? Does that equate to about the same thing?
Microsoft Word, a Microsoft Word document, a single page is typically, the default setting is 8.5 by 11. So if you fill that entire page, and most people also have it set, their default setting is single spaced typing. So if you fill up half that page, you're going to be at about 200 words. If you fill up the entire page, you're going to be at about 500. You can actually, in Microsoft Word as well, click on Tools and click on Word Count, and it'll tell you exactly what your word count is.
Now, that brings up another point. As you're talking, I'm thinking about this. Is there such a thing as too long of a blog? Where do you know when to stop?
Yeah, I think that if you get longer than, you know, say 500 words, you can really start to, unless it's clearly defined. Using as an example, this week on my blog, AskThePublishingGuru.com, I actually have a guest post on there from Web Design Schools Guide. They provided me with a great post that's actually 10 things you need to know about self-publishing. And it's actually a fairly long one. I would say if I did a word count on it, that it's probably somewhere in the 600 to maybe even 750 word count. But it's broken into very bite-sized chunks. So, and it can still be read in its entirety in probably no more than 10 to 15 minutes or less. And that's really what you're looking for as a blog post. It's usually people are just looking for bite-sized pieces of information about the specific topic that you know, claim to write about. And obviously I claim to write about anything that has to do with writing, publishing, or marketing books. And so, but like the 10, you know, that's one of the common kind of structures that I recommend for folks. Whatever your topic for your blog post is, you know, 10 things about this, or 5 things about this, or 3 things about, you know, 3 things you can do with this, this, or that, or 5 different vegetables that everybody should be eating, or, and that way it's, you don't have to necessarily title every single blog post with a number in it, but even if it's, you know, things you should know about self-publishing, you know, you might be your title, but then you still structure it in your mind that you're going to have 3, 5, 10 different points that you're going to make, and then that helps you to outline your subject or your blog post as well, because then you can just write a, you know, one paragraph about each of 3 different points that you're going to make, or 5 different points that you're going to make on your topic.
Now, by the way, I'm going to ask you a question. You got to promise me you won't let anybody know I've asked you this question, because the question in itself will affect my credibility as a techno guy, okay?
Okay.
Okay. What is a Kindle?
What is a Kindle?
Remember, I didn't ask that question. It didn't come from me. Oh, wait,
no, you're asking it for the sake of your listeners.
I have an email that came in from a listener in Chicago who wants to know what a Kindle is.
Okay, yes, so there you go.
Yeah.
Kindle is probably the single most important technology that came onto the scene that has affected the publishing industry more than anything other than probably the original creation of the Gutenberg press. That's how powerful the Kindle is.
Goes back a bit.
The Kindle is basically Amazon's device that they came out with for people to be able to read digital books in a handheld device that was about the size of a book. And they have a version that's about this. They have a version called the Kindle DX that's actually pretty close to. It's close to about 7 by 10. It's almost the size of an 8.5 by 11 document. for, you know, and but their pocket version, it's really inexpensive, like $139 now, I believe, is about the size of a trade paperback, 5x7, which is real close to the mass market to trade size type of paperback. So you feel like you're actually holding a book, and you can turn the pages on it just like you would a normal book as well by swiping your finger across the front of the page. Now, the Kindle really was the first of its kind to launch what now has become a very powerful market in these not only e-readers, as they're calling them, electronic reading devices, but they've now become even very strong computing devices like the iPad, for instance. In addition to the iPad being something that you can actually read books on, it's also basically a complete computer. I mean, you can buy a wireless keyboard that goes with it. You can type keyboard on the screen. You can use all kinds of software and surf the web without being connected using the wireless network, cellular towers. But what's powerful is more than 25 million different reader devices now, they're saying, are in the market as of the end of 2010. And they're projecting that it's the fastest growing part of the publishing industry. It's continued to grow every year for the last 5 to 8 years. The electronic book market has continued to double in size, minimum double in size every year as far as the number of books sold. In fact, last year, for the first time in history, Amazon said they sold more electronic books than they did printed books.
No, but so here's the question. What did that do to the publishing industry? There's a facet of the publishing industry that made money on the creation of a physical book. Has it had an effect on it?
It has had effect. I mean, it's still 80% or more of all books purchased in the world are physical printed books. However, what's powerful is that the year after year now, if we look at, you know, going back from 2005 forward, let's say, from 2005 forward, every year the number of printed books globally that have been purchased has declined, whereas the number of electronic versions of books has increased. And so what we see is now a consistent year-on-year trend for more than 5 consecutive years that electronic books are increasing, printed books are decreasing. So you could actually extrapolate out at the current rate of decline, you could actually extrapolate out that, you know, approximately 10 to 15 years from now, the printed book will cease to be purchased. Now, I don't think that that's ever going to happen. However, because I think it'll just change form where people will buy printed books as gifts, primarily keepsakes that you'll, you know, a nice ornate gilded edged, you know, gold stamps and fancy, you know, gift versions of books that you would, you know, someone would want to have on their shelf for the rest of their life type of thing. But I think that you'll find we're just going to continue to progress in a direction where the majority of books being purchased will be in electronic form every year as we continue to move down, you know, the timeline of life in general.
I hear you. Todd, I've been around authors for years and years and years and years now. And there have been times when an author has missed his window of or her window of opportunity. They've had to buy a ton of books. They've loaded their garage up, and they still got the books sitting in the garage. They couldn't sell them, or they've missed that specific time frame where it would have been effective. With the Kindle, that really eliminates that, doesn't it? How do I buy books on Kindle? How do I create that if it's just going to go over the internet, quote unquote? How do you deal with that same thing?
Well, it's actually, you still go through the same process of having a book properly edited, and you still want to have a cover design and the interior of the book laid out, whether you're self-publishing or a traditional publisher's handling the process. But, you know, because even though the book's taking digital form, it basically you want it to look very similar, and people are still going to go to, you know, in this case, Amazon.com to look at the book, and they're still going to see a cover design of the book, and when the book is actually purchased, it still needs to have a, you know, a professional flow and look and feel to it so that it reminds people and reads like a book should read. It's just a form that's basically taking a changing shape. And so, and what's powerful too is because of the ability, you can book much quicker than you can a printed book, and you can also keep your cost down significantly. Like you mentioned, it's possible now, and there's even many authors that are doing it recently. In fact, we talked about it four or five shows ago, that a traditional author that turned down $500,000 signing bonus,
yeah, remember that.
Or advance, as we call it in the industry, from a traditional publisher, and he's actually going to only publish his book himself in ebook form, because he feels that he can reach the target market for his material and make more money by self-publishing it himself on the Kindle.
So in essence,
also have the Nook, which is Barnes & Noble's version of the Kindle, and then of course the iPad. Those are the major, the major platforms for ebooks right now.
So realistically, from what I'm hearing as we move along with it, it's going to equal itself out. There'll be a level playing field, whether it's a book or it's a Kindle, whatever the case may be. The publishing company will still make their money. The author will still make their money, and so on and so forth. It's just a different way to look at it now.
It's a different way to look at it, but it's also eased the point of entry for authors. Many authors, used to have to primarily go through this several-year process of trying to find an agent, sending out, proposals of your book idea to literary agents, and in most cases experience, hundreds of rejections, and hopefully eventually find a literary agent that would say, yes, I think you have potential, I will represent you, and try to find a publisher that will publish you. And then they would begin, in many cases, a 90-day to 120-day or longer process of trying to find a publisher. And then if they were successful at finding a publisher, then the publisher would end up making you an offer and put you into their production schedule, which many times would take a year to 2 years before your book was out. So from the time you write a book as a brand new author to the time it actually gets into the hands of end users, in the old school methodology, would often take 3 to 5 years before your book actually ever came into existence. But now an author can literally write a book today, have it professionally edited, and within probably 30 days of even doing, really solid, good editing, design, so on and so forth, within 30 days from the day an author finishes writing it, they can have their book actually available for people to purchase on Kindle, Nook, iPads, and iPhones, etc. And that's one of the really powerful points. And they don't have to go through that whole process of trying to get traditionally published anymore.
Yeah,
And it's also not extremely expensive either. That's one of the misunderstandings, that's out there. People are like, well, I can't afford to try to publish my book myself, in most cases, for under $1,000, somebody can have a professional, version.
One of the things I forgot to mention, the person that I said had emailed in about the question about the Kindle. It was, I'm going to tell you the truth. I'm going to tell you who it actually was, Todd, because she didn't want anybody to figure anything out and just go ahead and pass it anyway. It was Nancy. Gotcha.
That doesn't surprise me.
Website we can find yet?
AskThePublishingGuru.com is the best way to get in touch with me. More than 300 articles on writing, publishing, and marketing books.
Wonderful. I loved every second of it. We'll see you next week. Take care.
All right, sir. Bye-bye.
Good night.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see, why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me?
I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
Dr. Greg Corbin with us. He is the author of Beyond Reason, Lessons from the Loss of a Gifted Child. Greg's an anesthesiologist, graduate of Duke University School of Medicine, an assistant professor of anesthesiology at Duke University Medical Center in Durham, North Carolina. He's involved in research and teaching neuroanesthesiology, regional anesthesiology, and pain management. And he was also the assistant professor of anesthesiology at the University of Virginia Medical Center in Charlottesville, Virginia. And let us say, Greg, hi, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. I think in and of itself, with the loss of your son, and we want to touch, obviously, the base of that so we know where we're going to go with this, but it's lessons from the loss of a gifted child. You know, you live a life and you think life is a certain way. You take the word science, and if you define science, science means something that there's provable. But sometimes there are those things that happen in your life that create a legacy that not only change you, but change the people you touch from that point on. So, Greg, let's start from the beginning. Your son was diagnosed. What was the diagnosis, and what did the doctor say to you about the longevity of his life?
Okay, well, Brian died playing baseball when he was 9. And when he was a baby, he had heart surgery. But everything went well, and we were given a clean bill of health. So we were told he should have a normal life, and he felt good, felt happy. There was nothing special we were doing, and after he died, the autopsy didn't show anything, and the incidence of sudden death, like he had playing baseball, is the same for somebody that's had the kind of surgery he did as a normal child. So when he told us about 9 months before he died that he was going to die, and that he would never make it till double digits, which was age 10. We didn't have any reason to suspect that there was, you know, that would really happen. We couldn't really understand why he would be doing that. So that was the beginning of it, the beginning of our journey. But he did know, and it became more and more obvious. And of course, when he died, all of the other things that were going on made it very obvious that there was a whole lot more to my reality than I had been taught. You know,
when we talk about more to your reality, I'm going to go back to the word science again. Science is something that's provable. Reality, sometimes we move into that world where it's not provable, and at the same time is as rock solid as something that is provable. So you're talking about a non-physical realm triggered by that grief.
Right. Well, what happened was, it was just, there was so many people that knew. Brian started getting depressed, having trouble sleeping. He was a wonderful kid. He was really gifted, much smarter than I was. And also he had stage presence, and he was a practical joker. He was always doing something. And then when he started talking about that he was going to die, he started getting very depressed and had trouble sleeping. And we took him to a psychologist because we couldn't understand what was going on. And the psychologist and Brian became great friends, but we didn't discover any issues to deal with. So, and then about 3-4 weeks before he died, he started coming out of his depression. And now, during this time, there were all kinds of people that knew that we were struggling with this. The teachers at school counselors, our minister, people in our church. And then it turns out that he gave himself a going away party the day he died and left us a goodbye note and a bunch of things like that. So it was very obvious that that it is possible to know the future. And when you say things can't be proved, well, all you need is a UFO to come land on the White House lawn once, sure, and you know that they exist.
Now, by the way, Greg, when we talk about provable and non-provable, there's a realm out there that goes beyond our linear ability to see. Let me ask you this. Did he, even with the psychiatrist, the psychologist he was talking to, did he ever once say where the information came from? Did he ever once say that this is what he knew from where?
No, he didn't. But as you know, as he got closer to his death, he became much more joyful. And then after he died, a lot of unusual things happened. In other words, he was a magical child, and the magic didn't die when he did. There was, you know, so many things that happened the day he died and afterwards. And then it turns out that he had a profound effect on me in my grief afterwards. And the profound effect was that I changed. I became a different person, and he had quite a bit of influence on that. And then some of the things that he do, and when I talk about these things, it's really, it was really hard for me at first because I was a scientist, didn't believe in any paranormal stuff. I'd been told that it was all bunk. And then all of these paranormal things started happening to me, precognitions, you know, glimpses of the future, things like that. And so he didn't talk about that, but I can tell you that where it comes from, I don't know, but it certainly happens. So after Brian died, and I couldn't understand all these things, so I started writing to try and figure out what had happened. You know, there was too much for me to understand.
Sure.
And I wrote all this stuff down, and it was like an ongoing project for about 15 years, because all these things kept changing. All these unusual, strange things kept happening, which I had been told couldn't happen. And so that's what I wrote in the book. One thing that I discovered was when I went to a support group for people that have lost, you know, parents who have lost a child, called the Compassionate Friends, it took me about 2 years before I could talk about this. And I'd talk about the paranormal things that happened. And then I'd, you know, for about 5 minutes, I'd tell Brian's story. And then I would be quiet. And then what amazed me the first time I did this was that the other parents would chime in with their paranormal experiences, too. Now, we all had dreams of our children. You know, we all felt that we were still connected with them in some way, even if, you know, even the people that didn't believe in God or anything like that. It was some process that seemed to be universal among all of us. But about half the parents had, like, evidence that would be admissible in court that their kid knew something about their death that was, like, accidental. Like, one example was there was a 12-year-old boy who died in a car accident the night before he died. He sat down and wrote a list of all of his life accomplishments and sat down with his mom and talked about them and then talked about what he wanted to accomplish in the future. And then another mother, who I worked with in the hospital, had a 4-year-old daughter who died during her daycare. She went down a slide and a ribbon caught around her neck and strangled her. The woman brought in a picture that this little girl had drawn 30 minutes before she died, showing herself dangling from the neck in dark colors, obviously dead. And then on the other side of the picture was her in bright colors, putting on a yellow halo with an angel in the sky dropping halos down to her. And this woman talked about this little girl, very much sounded very much like Brian, very gifted, full of life, full of joy, and she said that she never wanted to grow up and go to school like the other kids, and that she would tell her mom every day, you know what, I love you with a mad passion. Imagine this from a 4-year-old.
Sure.
So as I started sharing the story, I found out that what we call paranormal under these circumstances actually is normal. About half the parents had instances like this.
Let me hold you up for a second because I think there's an important question here. The mother that you were just talking about, what did she do with it? Did she move on to with her story? Did she touch other lives with it?
Well, I don't know. But that's what I wanted to do with Brian's story.
Sure.
And that's also why I wrote the book and why I created the website, because I discovered that all of these stories come together and you start hearing the same things over and over again. And it's very reassuring to know you're not the only one and that this child was trying to help you or trying to help themselves deal with their impending death.
But did they go beyond you? Did they go beyond the child themselves? I'm starting to hear a message here. You know, you get enough people who have a commonality in the message that comes from I can't think of anything more horrible than losing a child. A message that comes from that. And if there's enough people who respond in a certain way, then other people will start to really sit back and listen. And what I'm hearing is legacy. I mean, these kids have been chosen for a particular message. And if that message is in common and you walk away from each one of the parents that have gone through that, once they've gone through the grief and are able to talk about it, you might hear the same exact thing. I think that's where I'm going with it, and that's what I'm listening, I'm hearing you say.
Right. Well, what this journey took me on was the fact that all of these things happened after Brian died, all these unusual things, synchronicities. And as a result, I ended up at the Monroe Institute, which turns out is in my own backyard. I didn't even know it existed. And that was very helpful for me and very healing. The great emptiness I felt was really my pathway. It was a great emptiness that Brian's emptiness created or was there. And then all this love that I felt for him that was no longer physical. So that really became a spiritual path.
Sure.
And it took me lots of interesting places. And also another person that it took me to was Joseph Chilton Pierce. Are you familiar with him?
No, but I am familiar with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, The Death and Dying.
Right. Well, she hung around down here, too. It turns out she was a good friend of Bob Monroe, and she spent a lot of time with Bob and then actually settled over a couple hours away over in West Virginia for a while. So she was very tied into that, too. And I got to know her a little bit before she died.
Yeah, now 100 years ago or so, I did interview her before she passed away. But there was something that you were talking about. There was the bridge. There was there was the ideas that she had as regards to loss and healing. But there's an add-on to it that in dealing with and understanding grief that you got left with.
Well, what I discovered was that I kept trying to understand what's going on. Brian died publicly. I mean, this was so verifiable. We came home after he died, and he left up a parents' poll. He loved Calvin and Hobbes, and he memorized all the books, and sometimes he'd tell us the book and the page number if he wanted to tell us a joke, and we'd go look it up, and that's what he was trying to say. And he patterned himself after Calvin. Like Calvin would lock the babysitter in the bathroom, well, Brian would do that too. And Calvin had a parents' poll, and he used that to kind of torment his parents. I mean, if his parents did something he didn't like, he'd come up with a parents' poll that showed them that they had a low score. And Brian would do the same thing. So we usually came up around the middle on the parents' poll. Well, before he died, after he threw his going away party for himself, he went to his room and did a few things. And one thing he did was he came up with a parents' poll, and he left it out where we could see it. The first thing we saw when we came in the door after he died was the parents' poll he left up for us. And he, for the first time, gave us his perfect score, perfect 2000. And then he wrote a note on his door that, Brian's on a trip, don't worry about me. So there was all of this stuff that Brian was doing to let me and other people know that such things were possible. So the grief process, as I was going through it, what I discovered, you know, being a kind of an intellectual, a tin man character, someone who was like totally in their head. I always had trouble being emotional. I couldn't write any poetry. I couldn't write anything having to do with emotion. And so here I was having to deal with this where my intellectual capabilities didn't work. and nothing explained what was going on. So I kept asking, what is going on? And lots of things were going on that it took me a long time to figure out. And reading what the grief process was, which is mostly Kubler-Ross, didn't work. For example, you know, you're supposed to go through the stages of grief, right? Denial, sure. Anger, depression, bargaining, and then acceptance. And I noticed that I wasn't really doing that. And likewise, the other parents weren't doing that, and the other people. And as a physician, when I saw people dying, very few of them did that either. So I wasn't denying that he was dead, and I wasn't angry. It was obviously supposed to happen. I was no more depressed than I usually was. And who was I going to bargain with? And I was accepting it. But even though I accepted it, clearly there was something going on that I was moving along a path. So I was accepting something, but not everything. So I kept trying to figure out what's missing. Why didn't Kubler-Ross describe what I'm going through and the other people I see are going through? And that was one thread. Another thread is one of my hobbies has always been working with groups of people in challenge courses, you know, like rock climbing and obstacle sure. courses and Outward Bound sort of thing. And I've been doing that for like 40 years. And all my experiences sort of came together. And what I discovered is the grief process is really more like the Wizard of Oz, and which is kind of like a football game. If you're interested, I'll go into that. But
please.
It's everything we do, and if you're in the theater, the one thing that you learn is that the big breakthrough in direction and telling actors how to bring their characters to life is that all you have to know at any moment is what is your character missing? Where is the emptiness? What does your character want? And what is the clearest action to show it? So everything on the stage and everything in life occurs because we're missing something. There's a loss. Okay? And then every time you give a group a challenge, like, okay, this group has to get over this 12-foot wall, and you always have to frame the story that on the other side of the wall is something that they're missing that they can get if they go over the wall. And that yeah. creates, you know, a problem that has some meaning for them. Well, what I discovered was that when a group splits up, if you give them a challenge, they always split up into different roles. And the reason the Wizard of Oz keeps coming up is because it's universal. Those are the basic roles that we always split up into. And you can see the same thing at a football game. So you have a football team, they split up into different roles. You got the coaches, they're the brains. That's the Tin Man. And then you got the cheerleader, and the band, and the dancers, and they provide the spirit. That's the heart. And then you've got the warriors, the external. Okay, the heart, that's the scarecrow. Emotions with no brains.
Sure.
And then you've got the football players that go out and bump up against the other football players. Okay, and that's external conflict. That would be the witch. And then you've got the managers and the trainers. They deal with the team's internal conflicts, internal problems. And that would be internal conflict. And that would be the cowardly lion. Okay. And you could be cowardly, or you could be depressed, or you could be guilt. It's all directed against yourself. So those are the basic roles. And most people have favorite roles that they do. For me, I was a Tin Man, and I got angry easily. And those two roles basically worked for me, so I stayed in them. Now, what Kubler-Ross did, she was a psychiatrist, and she saw people that were sent to her. So she saw, if, let's say you had a woman who had a stillborn baby, okay, and she was in denial and carrying this dead baby around, which happens. It drives everybody nuts. You can imagine the other pregnant women on the obstetrics floor and the nurses. So they don't know what to do with her, and they try and get rid of her, and they send her to a psychiatrist. So she would see that. Or if the person were so angry, they were throwing things and wouldn't cooperate and yelling and screaming, same thing, that would send her to a psychiatrist. So Kubler-Ross would see that. So she saw the extreme behavior when it became very dysfunctional and people were stuck in it. Very depressed, crying, wailing, not taking their medicines, not cooperating, same thing. What she didn't see, she left out, in her stages, and they're not really stages. You don't go through them. They're just different ways we all have of coping. But she left one out. And which one did she leave out? She did anger. That's the witch. She did depression. That's the cowardly lion. She did the tin man. And that's the three. Okay? She left out the scarecrow. And the reason is, people also, a scarecrow, someone who's very emotional, you know, spacey, doesn't have a, not well grounded. The extreme version of that is anxiety and panic, which is very common. But if somebody's doing that on the floor at the hospital, that you can treat. You can give them a tranquilizer, and they will quit being a problem. So they didn't get, they're less likely to get sent to a psychiatrist. So that's why she didn't describe that, because she really wasn't sent it. And so she saw the extreme behaviors, but she didn't see the extreme behavior, or describe it at least.
Greg, let me hold you up. I think that the operative words are extreme behavior. We're starting to run out of time, but I've been listening to you very closely. And I think that the real core message in this is that obviously people are going to go through the processes of grief. We're going to have loss. It doesn't necessarily have to be the loss of a loved one, the loss of a child, a husband, a wife, somebody, a mom, a dad. But at the same time, the basic principles that you're talking about apply to everyone. If you don't get a job, if you get up in the morning and you don't feel good and you can't get to wherever you're going. And I really believe that the message in the book is universal. It's not the extreme of losing someone, and my goodness, who wants to do that? But the key is that there's an answer, and there is. You've said it, what the missing link basically is. But in everybody's life, you got a character, you got a description, you got the plot, which is going to give you the challenges. And what most people miss is the resolution. And there's where the disconnect is. And within the resolution is the answer to whatever it is. And I really believe that the legacy that he left you, that you move forward, you grew with, that emptiness, once you shifted the perception of what the emptiness was, it became the fullness, was the legacy to touch other lives. So if something does happen, that they know there's more than just whatever they define reality as.
Oh, sure. Yeah, the big lesson that Brian had to teach was that there is magic in the world. Children are closer to it than adults. And the magic comes out of emptiness. If you know what's going to happen, if you understand it, then that's not magic. But the things that really transform your life, bring things together, move you along where you become a different person, they're beyond reason, which is the name of the book. This is things that flow out of the emptiness, and it's a very creative space. The bigger the loss, the bigger the grief, the more creative the opportunity. And I don't mean to belittle anybody's loss.
I do know
when I'm with somebody who's grieving, I'm not afraid anymore because I can see that this process has a very great potential for transformation.
Greg, let me tell you where I think the magic in this is. When you really come down to it, 100 years from now, when none of us are here anymore, and somebody's in grief, and somebody else says, you know, you should read Beyond Reason. There's the legacy, and there's the magic.
Mm-hmm.
It's alive.
Yeah, that's
the two of us alive with this, yes. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We're starting to run out of time, Greg. Let me ask you this. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Right. Okay, well, I created the website, beyondreason.info, beyondreason.info, so that people could learn about Brian's story, because there's so many more things that were really amazing that I don't have time to talk about. And also, a place where people could share their stories. And my hope is that enough people would post their own stories, and that people would have a place to go, and they could understand that there's much more going on in this world than what we've been taught should happen. There's all kinds of things that are really fantastic. And they don't make it into the media. So I wanted to create that. So it's beyondreason.info. Hope people will come and enjoy it.
Wonderful. Hey, Greg Corbin, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy.
If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore from now and evermore. That's all. That's all.
Melinda Dennis with us. Melinda Dennis is the author of Real Life with Celiac Disease, Troubleshooting and Thriving Gluten-Free. She is a nutritional coordinator, research investigator within the Celiac Center at the Beth Israel Radio Susie. Give me that word. Deaconess. I got the word. Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. In Boston, Massachusetts, diagnosed with celiac disease 21 years ago. She's a registered dietitian who specializes in the treatment of patients with celiac disease and gluten intolerance. She's offered several journals, articles on the nutritional management of celiac disease. And let us say, Melinda, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. I couldn't say deaconess.
But now you did.
Now I got it. I can say it five times and it'll never go out of my head again. By the way, let's start from scratch and let's lay a base and say celiac. What is celiac disease? And then we can work from there.
Okay. Celiac disease is the most common genetic autoimmune disorder in the world. It is a full-blown disease. And we did not know this fact just a mere few years ago. But it is the most common genetic autoimmune disease in the world, outnumbering a lot of the other autoimmune diseases.
Okay, now when we say autoimmune, what do we mean?
We mean that this disease in particular triggers a response so that your own body attacks itself. And specifically what that means is that when somebody with celiac disease ingests gluten, which is in the protein in wheat, rye, and barley, and contaminated oats, their body mistakenly acknowledges it as a toxin and launches an autoimmune attack on itself,
killing
the lining or damaging the lining of the small intestine where your nutrients are absorbed.
So it recognizes it as a foreign body, quote-unquote, not something that you're producing yourself, and the body is set up to attack anything foreign in it to heal itself, and at the same time, this is nothing that is foreign. It just doesn't recognize it and throws off a different response.
Exactly. It's a mistaken response.
Ah, okay. Now, does this come from nutrition?
No. Celiac disease comes from three main components, we believe. The first is that you must have the genetic predisposition to this disease. You must have one or both of the genes. They're called HLA-DQ2 and HLA-DQ8. So you have to have the genes for it, which means it runs in families. You have to have been exposed to gluten at one point in your life, and gluten is easy for all of us to be exposed to when we're introduced to solid foods after breast milk, like wheat cereal. And then we believe that there's some physiological trigger that has to take place, and for a lot of people this ends up being acute or chronic stress, a difficult pregnancy, a difficult surgery, a virus, a bacteria, a parasite, something that causes trauma to the body. And then ultimately, celiac disease will present itself in a person who's primed for that.
Okay, now when you say, and I think those are the operative words, the person who's primed for that. Melinda, if you're not primed for it, will the body do its normal, you know, attack of what's causing the problems, and then you end up healing and getting well. But if you have that genetic predisposition, if you are gluten sensitive, then you're just wide open for this to hit then.
Right. If you're gluten sensitive, right, and we have to be so careful because the terminology gets really complicated here, but
sure.
There's out there, there's celiac disease, there's the wheat allergy, which is a completely different immune-mediated response, and then there's gluten intolerance, what we call gluten intolerance. The third category are people who don't have celiac disease. They don't have the autoimmune disease, but they have a functional disorder. They also cannot tolerate gluten. They're very, very sensitive to it. And the same symptoms that people with celiac disease have can be manifested in people with gluten intolerance. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because there are more people in the United States right now, approximately 6 million, who follow the gluten-free diet because of gluten intolerance, and really only 1 million people diagnosed with celiac disease, so far greater number.
Let me tell you what I'm hearing, and stop me if I'm wrong here. I'm not a clinician, and I don't have expertise in celiac disease. But what I'm hearing here is there's a high possibility that we've always had the same amount of people affected, but we didn't recognize it. And I think
exactly.
That might be. Okay, all right. So we
exactly.
have
so the prevalence has increased. In fact, the prevalence has doubled over 20 to 30 years. And the United States is quite far behind other countries, primarily in Europe, at recognizing and diagnosing celiac disease. So you might have heard a lot of people say that they've been looking around for, you know, 5, 10 or more years for a diagnosis to their problems. It's just that it manifests in so many different areas of the body, in fact, any area of the body, that it can easily be disguised or confused with something else.
Okay, so you mentioned stress before. So let's say I'm very stressful, but I happen to have a very stressful kind of an occupation, job, whatever the case may be. So I go to the doctor, I say I've got stress, the doctor gives me some Prozac, and now it calms me down, and at the same time, I've got the celiac disease, I've got it building within me because the doctor didn't know what it was that was really causing the problem. So how do we know who to go to that can target what we're coming in with?
So maybe we should first, it's a really good question, we should first talk about all the different ways it can manifest itself so people who might be listening could think, oh, if this is me, maybe I should go get tested and talk about how to do that. But, you know, if you've got unexplained depression or infertility or liver disease, elevated liver enzymes, or trouble with balance or seizure disorders, anemia, bone degeneration, sort of like unexplained osteoporosis or unexplained osteopenia, diarrhea, gas, bloating, or constipation, any of those things, you can see how widespread it is. And, of course, the famous rash, dermatitis herpetiformis, which is how I was diagnosed, it's a very, very specific rash, any of those are possible signs and symptoms of celiac disease. So if you come in and you're stressed out and you can point to one or more symptoms or even none, and you want to be tested for celiac disease with your primary care doctor, they could simply run what we like to call the celiac panel, which is two blood tests. The total IgA, capital I, lowercase g, capital A, and the IgA-TTG, which stands for tissue transglutaminase. Those are antibody levels, and if your TTG blood test is elevated, then there's a suspicion that you might have celiac disease, and you may go on to have a small bowel endoscopy, a biopsy.
So let's say, for instance, that I'm listening tonight, and I'm hearing one of the symptoms that could lead to celiac, and I go to the doctor takes the blood test. We find it. Now, is this a fixable thing? Is celiac fixable?
Yes. So if they take your blood test, you have the biopsy, or in some way that you are diagnosed with celiac disease, what you can do, though we can't cure it, we can absolutely treat it through the gluten-free diet. The gluten-free diet avoids those toxic proteins that are bad for people with celiac disease, namely wheat, rye, barley, contaminated oats. and gives you a safe gluten-free diet that basically nourishes you for the nutrients that you may have been missing. You have to pay really close attention to your gluten-free diet because you can't just assume that following it off the books is necessarily healthy. And I don't know if we have time to talk about that, but it would be wonderful.
No, okay, well, go ahead and talk about that. This is critical. This is something that we should know. Go ahead and move in that
direction,
please.
So there's a misconception that the gluten-free diet is healthier than a gluten-containing one, but you have to do it very carefully. In other words, the gluten-free diet can be naturally low in iron and fiber and B vitamins, calcium, vitamin D, magnesium, and zinc, and that's a lot. So what we want to do is we want to look to see if the people who are on a gluten-free diet are making sure to use healthy, wholesome gluten-free grains, not just rice and corn and potatoes, which are low in fiber and tend to convert to sugar really quickly in the body, but healthy grains like amaranth and quinoa and millet and teff and buckwheat. Buckwheat has an unfortunate name, but it's not related to wheat. Yeah. And also lean proteins.
Why is that an unfortunate name?
Because it has the word wheat in it. It's very confusing for people.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Take but it's something. Related to rhubarb.
I got it. Okay.
Yeah.
A little slow on the uptake, but I got you.
Okay. So those are the nutrients. Those are the vitamins and minerals that's low in, but you can make up for your loss of B vitamins and iron and fiber by using, you know, moderate amounts of the healthy grains rather than relying on the unhealthy low fiber ones, which also can lead to weight gain, by the way, and constipation.
Okay, so weight gain and constipation also could be a symptom of celiac.
Sure, that's right. You no longer have to be have had profound or dramatic weight loss or have diarrhea or loose stools to be a celiac. The classic face of celiac disease now is constipation and overweight or normal weight or obese. Doesn't matter. There's all ranges of weights these days.
Now, by the way, on your website, if I go to your website, what am I going to find?
If you go to Beth Israel Deaconess's website, you'll find our celiac center. That's www.bidmc.org/celiac center. If you go to our books website, Real Life with Celiac Disease, you'll see all about the book and the 50 chapters that were written by world experts on their topics. And if you go to Delete the Wheat, you'll see what I do for patients across the country and clinicians who are training and adventure retreats and things like that, all about gluten life, gluten-free life.
Now, by the way, well, I think it's extremely important. One of the things that you brought up is somebody's the possibility of celiac disease, and yet you didn't know that you had it.
Yes. I think because 95% of the people who have celiac disease currently right now on the planet actually don't know that they have it.
Man,
it's particularly true in the United States. It is surprising, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Melinda, and I think that the job that you guys are doing are phenomenal because somebody can go through their entire life, have all of these problems, and at the same time, never a clue what it would take to fix it and to, well, I'm going to say manage it. Well, let's not say fix it, but to manage it. And if you can manage it through food, that's powerful.
It is. It does not require a medication in most cases. It's about the diet and you have control over it. It's a very, very wonderful way to look at it. And I'm glad you mentioned that.
We're just about out of time. One more time, please, with the website.
Okay. The book's website is reallifewithceliacdisease.com. The book was published by the American Gastroenterological Association, and there are 50 world experts who joined us. So it spans the lifespan and addresses complications and all sorts of issues and how it's handled in clinic, nutritionally and medically.
Wonderful. Hey, well, thank you so much for being here. Melinda Dennis, I've appreciated your time, and hopefully somebody heard that loud and clear out there.
Thank you, Michael.
Oh, my pleasure. Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are. I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight.
I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own. Ah.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And Dr. Veronica Tomer is with us, and she's the author of The Lean Guide for the Business Traveler, Smart Eating, Smart Eating for On the Go. And I'll tell you what, most people really have to take a look at that. She's been traveling for business and healthcare professional for about a half a decade now, worked for the pharmaceutical industry, and spent the last 3 years in the health outcomes division of a giant in the realm of diabetes. Although her job included demonstrating improved outcomes for patients, her own health was taking a toll through the stress, the fast-paced living, and the unique lifestyle of the business traveler with very limited time for eating healthy and exercising. And Veronica, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. And I'll bet that hits probably a tremendous amount of people out there, even if you're not traveling, just being on the go. And look what it could do to you. Look at the end result of your health if you don't take the time and take care of it.
Exactly. That's the whole issue, is that we've lived in a very fast-paced life, and we really don't do those reality checks to really see where we are with our health and with our eating.
Oh no! You're in meeting after meeting, and then all of a sudden you're hungry. You got another meeting to go to, so where do you go? You go to McDonald's,
right? Or in a lot of the corporate meetings, which was a big part of my life, is you have these giant buffets during meetings and corporate meetings, and you start your day off with a big buffet for breakfast. Then you have a big buffet for lunch. And then you go out to a very fancy restaurant for dinner because your colleagues and your bosses, and if you're from out of town, they will take you to nice restaurants. Or if you're entertaining customers, you will also take your customers to restaurants. So everything typically revolves around a lot of eating and very little activity. And if you do this week in, week out, and this is your lifestyle, then you can see how you can easily put on a lot of weight. And it's very difficult for people to really stop and see and really realize what's happening to their bodies if this is your lifestyle.
Veronica, where was it for you that you realized that there was a problem here? Was it a weight gain? Were you feeling not good? Where was that point where you just couldn't take another step already?
Well, you know, I've been living this lifestyle for about 5 years, and it's very corporate America pretty much lives this lifestyle. You typically live very much surrounded by food, and I had a reality check just spending so much time in airports and spending so much time just looking at people and just realizing, you know, we all know we're in the midst of an obesity epidemic, but it hit home really when I was just seeing a lot of my colleagues balloon, and they were gaining 50, 80 pounds. And, you know, I've always struggled with my weight pretty much my entire life, but I've never ballooned. I've always been managing my weight just by being conscious of what I eat. And the minute my guard is down, the minute I lose that you know, that guard, my weight just creeps up. So I realize that, you know, if this is something, amidst my busy work schedule, amidst being a mom, having kids at home, and still being able to do this, you know, I think this is something that I really wanted to be able to share with people and let them know that if you don't have that reality check, if you really don't do that inventory, you know, it's really, it becomes an issue. It becomes something that, you know, you have to really remedy along the lines if you really don't do that reality check. So that's really how this came about, is really spending so much time in airports and really watching a lot of my colleagues really struggle with their issues along with mine as well. But that's really what the book is about.
So we're really saying be intentional as opposed to accidental. Accidental meaning you could be faced with everything that you're talking about, and who knows what the end result is going to be. But if you're intentional, if you're mindful of what you're doing in front, then you can manage it. You can get some kind of control over it. So a couple of things that somebody should look at before they even start a life like this, or if you're in the middle of it, to slow down, stop, take a look at it. What are some of the steps to take to avoid this?
Exactly. And I think corporate America is growing to being, you know, we work more remotely every day. We work in you know, different states, and we just communicate more via email, via conference call. So this is a trend that's growing these days. But to answer your question, I mean, there's a number of things that you can do to be proactive as opposed to reactive. And that is really the key, is that you really, when you're really business savvy, business very business oriented, and you have that corporate mindset, typically what happens is that you're just focusing on your work and you don't really take time to be proactive with your health. And so there's a number of things that you really need to do, and this applies to whether you're a business traveler, regardless of whether you're a business traveler or you're, you know, traveling for leisure. There's a number of things that I suggest that you always incorporate when you're going to go on a trip, because there's always that feeling of self-indulgence and permissiveness when you're going to go on a trip. So the number one thing that you have to do is always have a game plan. You always have to think about the probability, not the possibility, that you're going to be eating more and that you're going to indulge or overindulge. So it's important to have a plan of action on your trip. Don't leave it to chance. Always have a game plan. The second thing is that you really have to be mindful about what you put in your mouth. I mean, you have to budget your meals. If there's a chance that you're going to have three big meals in one day, again, this applies to whether you're traveling for business or for leisure, more now that, you know, a lot of people are going on vacation, they're going on cruises. If you don't budget your meals and if you don't have a gauge of how much, you know, your body can handle, you know, don't have three supersized meals in a day. If you know you're going to have a big sit-down dinner, then budget your calories for that day and just allow for that cushion for that big meal. The third thing is don't – oh, forgive me. Go ahead.
Well, that's okay. I was just going to say, you mentioned buffets. There's always buffets. It is so hard when somebody is so involved in what they're doing not to walk into a buffet, get hungry, and forget everything but filling your stomach up at the time.
Exactly. So that's one of the biggest traps that's out there, is the buffets. And they're very popular because they're cheap. It happens a lot when people go on vacation, they go on cruises, they go on any trip, family trips, or, you know, whatever it may be. But it's an eating trap. And, you know, how you guard yourself against that is you don't want to set yourself to be starving when you're in front of a buffet. You want to be able to have, you know, small meals during the day so that you have, you know, some level of consciousness and you don't overeat in that buffet. The other thing you do in a buffet is that you're going to fill your plate, but you're going to fill it with foods, you know, that are going to be enough for one sitting. You don't want to keep going up, which is the biggest flaw of a buffet-style dinner. So you're going to keep going up. You can rake up to, you know, 3,000, 4,000 calories in a buffet, which is lethal. I mean, that's really where you really get that, you know, extra pounds in a trip is when you're surrounded by buffets. So it's an eating trap that you have to be guarded and conscious about. There's one major thing that I always recommend is don't starve yourself all day either, waiting for the giant meal. You don't want to do that because what happens is you're over hungry, you have that impaired judgment, you overeat out of the hunger that you're going to have for that one giant meal. So what you want to do is at least have, sensible meals during the day or snacks that you can eat, during the day. I always recommend that travelers carry smart snacks, what I call smart snacks, which is pack your bags, all your bags, you know, your carry-on, your suitcase, fill it with protein bars or nuts and trail mix, anything that's going to be able to protect you from making those rash decisions when you're not able to think rationally and you know, you're going to overeat because you're starving. And then your body also stores more fat when you go 12 hours without eating. The longer the periods that you don't eat, your body has a mechanism for overprotecting or protecting itself for long periods of starvation. So you store more fat when you really don't eat during regular time frames during the day. So whether you do that on a regular basis or you do that when you're going on vacation, your body compensates for these behaviors. So you always want to be eating small meals during the day and guard yourself. Protect yourself from having that gigantic meal or, you know, very large meals at one sitting. That's the worst thing you can do.
Veronica, I think one of the most important reasons to pick up the book, The Lean Guide for the Business Traveler, there are so many people traveling today. It used to be there was that place whereby you'd be at your desk 8 hours a day, 9 to 5. It doesn't work that way anymore. You've got, you know, you've got your iPads, you've got your Blackberries, and you can do everything you need to do. And people travel today because they're not stuck in one spot. They can be reached. They can get information back very rapidly. And you're right. We live in a very fast-paced, microwavable world, and it has its pitfalls, and you're pointing out probably 90% of them right now. And those pitfalls can, in the end result, can kill you.
Exactly, exactly. So I always say, you know, you've got to be very, you've got to be proactive with your health, not reactive. And I think, you know, all of us, you know, tend to just focus on our priorities. We don't make health our priority enough. I've been a pharmacist for over 20 years, so I've been on the side of treatment, and I know what it is when you get sick, when you get an illness, when you get diabetes, hypertension, high cholesterol, all these things I've dealt with for 20 years, you know, as a clinical pharmacist. So certainly I can appreciate, you know, when you're proactive with your health, when you're mindful of what you eat, how you feed your body, you know, our bodies have very smart ways of reacting to what we do to it. So certainly you want to be as kind to your bodies as we can possibly be. And one major thing is, you know, the way we eat today is just very fast-paced. We just tend not to really pay attention to what we're eating. That's why we're in the midst of an obesity epidemic right now and a diabetes epidemic as well. So it's one of the things that I always suggest, you know, with the gadgets that you mentioned, is always put something in whatever gadget you have, whether it be, you know, BlackBerry, an iPhone, an iPad, whatever you carry with you, gadget of your choice, and put something in there that's going to remind you to be to make healthier choices. And you'd be surprised how these things become part of your thinking, which is part of the problem. We don't think about these things enough during the day when we're making our business plans or when we're planning what we're going to have on our agendas. And it's a very simple habit that really can make a difference in our health if we do these things. So.
And it can be simple as a 5x7 card that you bring with you and you put in front of the mirror when you're getting dressed and ready to go to a meeting, and it just says, be careful what you eat. Just some kind of an indicator. Trigger. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I really believe what we're dealing with here is also a mindset. It's just a shift in perception, because too many people fall prey, quote unquote, to those wonderful buffets. You know, I spent a year on cruise ships, years and years ago, about 30 years ago, whatever it was. And the one thing that I learned, the one thing dangerous about a cruise ship, which has to do with your topic right now, never get between a passenger and food.
Absolutely, yes. That is very true, very true.
Yeah. And the buffet is not your friend. Okay, oh, there's your next book. The buffet is not your friend.
It's not your friend, not your friend. And I think, I mean, you know, people love cruises. This time of year, everybody goes on a cruise or they go on a vacation. There's buffets everywhere. But I think it's having also that gauge as to how much, before you even go on that trip, is to really think about, oh my God, you know, am I going to come back with those 5-10 pounds more? And how much is it going to take me to lose these extra pounds? Because as you know, 5 pounds become 10, 10 becomes 15, and so on. So you really have to have that proactive mindset as well as to what's your leeway for that trip, and what you have to have that game plan. I'm all about that game plan, and I really advocate for people to really think about it as you're packing your bags, as you're putting your suitcase together. Think about what you're going to be eating, how you're going to be eating. And you know, it's very, very, if you plan, you can come back. It's likely that you might put on 1 or 2 pounds. You don't want to come back having those 5-10 pounds over your weight since you know. From the time that you packed your bags and left. So
here at Lavender, Veronica, we're starting to run out of time. Website we can find you at.
Yes, the website is theleantraveler.com. And there's a lot of information on eating smart, what I call eating smart. And it's about creating that game plan. There's also information. I have an interview, a person that I interview every month, and there's information about experiences, people that I've interviewed over my travels during the years, as well as apps and resources and links. So there's just a wealth of information that I think you can get out of the website.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us. And I think it's an issue that most people aren't even aware of. They don't even think about. And I'm glad you're bringing it up to the table.
Thank you. And the name of the book, just let me repeat it again, it's The Lean Guide for the Business Traveler. And lean means living educated about nutrition on the go. That's what this is all about. So
love every second of it. And thank you and take care.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good night.
So why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see it.
I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Dan Stendler with us coming up.
And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Dr. Dan Sindelar with us. He is the author of Refresh Life, The Missing Piece to Add Years to Your Life and improve your health. From heart attacks and strokes to cancer to preterm births, the research that he's done and the experience that he's had revealed that the key to preventing the world's biggest killers has been lurking right under our noses. He's a graduate from the Washington University School of Dental Medicine, has been practicing in the St. Louis area for 30 years now. He's the director of the Midwest Center for Oral Systemic Health and the co-founder of the American Academy of Oral Systemic Health. And the book, again, the name of the book is Refresh Life, the Missing Piece to Add Years to Your Life and Improve Your Health. Dan High, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be here.
Oh, thank you. You know, we just take our gums and our teeth and our mouth for granted, don't we?
Well, we really do. And part of my journey on this was, you know, I've been practicing dentist for some time, and I've seen this with my patients and over the years. I even joke in my practice, the older individuals that really seem to have a lot going on in their lives, they may be even in their 80s and 90s, all have the gums of a 16-year-old. And I joke about that with them. And so it just was something pretty evident to me. And now the research is showing that there's a pretty good reason for this.
Now, when we talk about reason for them, how important are the gums? You know, are there indicators? Are there symptoms? Are there discoloration? What do we see in our gums that would be the first trigger that something could be wrong?
One of the obvious calls for action is bleeding gums. And an absolute zero tolerance for bleeding gums is very important with the current research.
Okay, now with the research in and of itself, have we had advances over the years? Was it those same symptomatic approaches that you used years ago as we do today? Have we learned more about the relationship between the mouth, the gums, the teeth, the mouth, those diseases that we can have hidden right there, and our internal problems, i.e. heart attacks and so on and so forth? Does it start right there in the mouth?
Well, historically, the thought was that the mouth was the result of the problems that people had. But now the research is showing that a good part of it also starts there. We have a lot of research on portal of entry, a lot of research on influences with inflammation. The Surgeon General states that over 80% of Americans have some form of gum disease. Gum disease is an inflammatory disease, and also heart attack, stroke, diabetes, to name a few, are also are inflammatory diseases. And the research is showing that there's an influence and also a vast increase in the problems of those diseases with gum disease. An example, heart attacks. If you have gum disease, you're twice as likely to have a heart attack. If you have gum disease, you're also three times as likely to have a stroke. So it does have a strong effect on our health.
Now, I want to go back to the simple and the basic. You know, one of the things that people are concerned about, obviously, is bad breath. You get out into a public situation, this is not something that you want, and especially if you go out on a first date. But bad breath, it goes beyond something social. Bad breath is an indicator of something, isn't it?
Well, definitely. You know, my book is titled Refresh Life, and this subject we have to, you know, nobody wants to hear all the bad. So the book is about things that improve life and improve health. But when we look at it, bad breath is a sign of bacterial activity, and that is one of the indicators also.
Yeah, by the way, Dan, when we talk about hearing the bad stuff, you need to hear the bad stuff to be able to realize that there's symptoms of something. The bad stuff is your body's way of saying, take a look, there's something more to this than quote-unquote meets the eye. So the bad stuff, yes, then when we find out what the bad stuff is and realize that there can be, you know, either manage it or fix to it or prevent something else, then we can get into the prevention stuff. But I wonder how many people realize the consequence of bad breath, the consequence of gums that turn a certain color and so on and so forth. I think those things are what most people have no idea even exists. They just take it for granted, and the next thing you know, they're spending tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars in the hospital that could have been fixed at the dentist office.
Absolutely, Michael. And you hit that right on the head. Yeah, there's a lot of things that are overlooked, and we've gotten into, over the years, a mindset that the mouth is not really a part of the body, and it's a major part of the body, and the location and the communication with the rest of the body is very important. We have more blood vessels there than almost anywhere else in our body. We have a portal of entry. It's why we breathe, how we eat, and sure. It definitely communicates with the rest of our systems. An example of the importance of it, if you took the area or the space, the area around the teeth, if you have bleeding gums, it is approximately the size of the inside of your forearm from your wrist to your elbow, which is a pretty good size area. Now, if that area on your arm was bleeding or infected, they would have you rushed to the hospital. You'd be treating stat. And yet, there are so many people that have a similar situation in their mouth, and we've gotten to overlook that over the years and not realizing how that does affect our health.
Now, by the way, with kids today, where do you catch it in front? I would imagine that parents do not think of getting their kids to the dentist once a year and at least getting a checkup to see what's going on. Can we prevent this with kids? Can we take a look at their mouths and anticipate what could possibly happen and stop it from happening?
Hey, you bring up a great point here, too. I look at three different areas. Prevention is the best. And if you can start someone off at a very young age and get them into the proper habits, they can really eliminate the mouth having any influence on their overall health. That would be ideal if we can get them to start some real simple patterns, as simple as flossing twice a day, as simple as brushing twice a day, seeing a dentist to make sure nothing gets past the point of acceptable. That is a great way to approach it. That way we're not trying to catch up as time goes on.
Well, I want to touch on one of your talking points because I think it's critical. We get older, we're going to get out into the world, and people are going to judge us based on what they see. And one of the things that you talk about, and I think it's critical, is to whiten or not to whiten. Is there a danger in whitening, or is there a way to do it where it is safe?
You know, my gut feeling is as long as it's monitored, as long as someone's not just addicted to it, where they're just nonstop, because there can be some damage to the teeth in that regard. Some of the whitening agents, the take-home ones, over-the-counter and from the dentist, have a little bit of an oxygenating agent in there. And a good part of the problem that I talk about in the book with increased inflammation is from the bacteria that do not like oxygen. And those are the ones that can live inside of us. So a treatment for that is not the whitening, but the whitening is not a problem as long as it's monitored and as long as it's, I don't like the ones that heat up teeth, which are some of the systems that have been out and they come and go. But as long as it's done with moderation, there's no problem with that.
Okay, now, Dan, stop me if I get off track because I want to stay on focus with exactly what it is the book that can offer. But take somebody like me. 35 years ago, I got my teeth bonded. And for somebody to get their teeth whitened when they've been bonded, there is a problem there. What do you do in a case like that?
You mean as far as whitening after they've been bonded?
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. With that, the bonding will not lighten. And so there's a problem with that because then you get some difference of shades, and that can cause some problem. Actually, the whitening systems also will cause a little bit of tightening of the gums, And so if you're not careful, you can actually shift the margin or the area of the gum line, which will sometimes have not the best look.
Okay, so they have to go through life now and never smile.
Don't you ever. You must smile all the time, and I can hear it through your voice. You smile a lot. Yeah.
And a lot. Okay, but so what I'm hearing really is there, if you do it the right way, there's a fix for almost anything as long as you get in and have somebody who is a professional take a look at it and be able to work with it unless it goes long. Now, the three things that every mouth needs every day.
Well, definitely, as good as we have right now, use something between the teeth to clean them. Something. Floss is probably the easiest. The unfortunate one there is not enough people floss. Do you have any idea how many people floss twice a day?
Oh, I would venture to guess if you could hit 3%, you got a lot.
You're right on it. That's it. So that is the exact, which up to this point has been about as good an approach as dentistry has had. There are new products coming out daily, and I am a board member and a co-founder of the American Academy for Oral Systemic Health, and there are quite a few new approaches that are coming to me daily through this, and it's very exciting because it will address the idea of eliminating those bacteria that we don't like. There are about, I guess, five or six, and if I name them, I'll bore everybody. But let
me ask you this real quick. Are there products that we can get to take care of these things up on your website?
Yes, there are.
Okay, so if we take a look at the website, then we can see the different products that will allow us to address the problems that we have.
Yes, that's my website does have that, and I think that's important because most people aren't flossing and they feel like they're failing and they're guilty, and you know every dentist sees this. You know, have you been flossing? Well, sure I have the last 2 days right before checkup, and that's human
10 minutes
nature.
Before I got here. Yeah,
we do that. Yes.
Are there products to help floss?
You know, there are some brushes you can use in between teeth that I find patients really use. Those are my favorite. You know, it's kind of like jogging shoes. You know, it used to be, what's the best shoe or the best workout shoe? Well, the one you use is the one that works. And
now, by the way, I wasn't going to say anything because I'm a non-flosser, but I've got those little brushes.
And they work very well.
They work pretty good.
Yes, they do. And just anything to disturb that, all the terms are changing. We've done research, and now it's called biofilm. And biofilm is real similar to the bacteria set up in our blood vessels. The biofilm is not good. And as the research comes out, it shows that this is a real important thing to address.
No. Again, on the website, will it take us to the different pages on the website for each individual product, and it allows us to see what it is that product can do to keep us to better our lives?
Yes. And there's some of those are only available through a dentist, and I didn't write the book to, make the dentist busy or myself busy, but it's just some real simple things that I feel really can add good, healthy years to our lives. Slow down the effect of the mouth. There's a current thought in inflammatory disease of inflammatory burden, which is the accumulation of all the things we have in our daily lives that are making us susceptible to inflammatory disease. And everybody has a tipping point. And if you look at it like gum disease and lack of oral health is one of the five or six major influences on that. If you can reduce that, you vastly improve your chances of going over the top into some of those disease states.
Now, one of the things I think that are important about product, you mentioned early on, we don't want to talk about all the bad stuff. Well, we talk about the bad stuff, but then you have to have what can bridge you to the good stuff. And that's why I think talking about the products are extremely important, because without the products, you're not going to get the full maximum effect of what the good stuff is, and that in and of itself is something that I think people need to know, the importance of someone's mouth. And if you really think about it, your entire health starts right there, what you eat. We're nothing more than an electrochemical factory, and what you eat turns into whatever that chemical is that's going to go to that part of your body that's going to cause it to work or not to work. And that's where it starts. So if you've got a handle on, let's call it the gateway, if you've got a handle on the gateway, then you've got a handle on the rest of it.
Absolutely. And nutrition starts there, and digestion starts there. It has a lot of influence on every part of our health. I agree completely.
No question. And can we get the website one more time?
The website is www.refreshrightnow.com.
Wonderful. And then we can find you, we can find the products, we can find the book on the website?
Absolutely. We also have on the website, it's a free oral health test and a health risk assessment. And it's real helpful. It's some simple questions that an individual will just check off that are pertinent to their health. And then the result of that, they'll get a graph or an assessment showing where they stand on certain areas. And then it'll also have a link to some information that they can look up and further help themselves with reduction of the problems.
Dan, I was going to close it off now. We're running out of time. But what I think is important on the assessment, what are some of the things that we're going to see on the assessment? What are the kind of questions that you'll ask?
Well, another part that I include in the book is sleep apnea, which is a huge influence on our health also. And it doesn't seem like that would be an oral treatment or an oral health issue, but about 50% of those, I think they say 17 million Americans are sleep apneics. There are more than diabetes in the United States. Of those, if treated with CPAP, which is a wonderful treatment, about 50% are non-compliant. The problem is the jaw drifts back and it blocks off their breathing. There are oral appliances that we use in my office, and I actually use one myself. I've been an apneic for about 10 years, and that reduces, if not eliminates, the apnea. I have that on the assessment also. Plus, and you're just asking some of the questions, if they snore, if they, you know, the amount and all of that. But that's another side of this, and all of those are addressed on the assessment.
Okay, so really, when we're talking about your mouth, you're talking about the effect on your sleep, your heart, your digestive system. I would venture to guess the oxygen flow through your body, because it goes into your heart and it comes out completely different when that happens. So we're really looking at everything that goes on, every system in the body. It begins and it's affected by what goes in your mouth and how you take care of that mouth.
Absolutely.
That's scary.
Well, it is scary, and yet the cures for this are very simple and easy, and I address them. There's a lot of things a person can do, and I address them in the book. And but it's more an issue of realizing how important this is to your health. And then the steps are pretty easy. That's why I wrote this book, was to just help people live healthier lives and not have the drain on their system for something that does not take a lot of effort to take care of and to get back. And that's why the name of the book is Refresh Life. Everybody deserves that. And we forget the most important asset we have is our own health. And yet, well, you could add 10 years to your life. Yeah, the research shows if you eliminate that as an influence on your system, well, I mean, the book I priced at $11.95 purposely, so as many people as can get that book. And if it has that influence, it's just a real simple thing to do to add some years to your life and improve your health.
Dan, I hear you loud and clear. We're just about ready to close it down. And if somebody missed the website, then it's going to be up on our website so they can find it there. And there's a search to find out where to find a particular person. So, by the way, thank you for all your work. Thank you for being here tonight.
You bet. Thank you, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Off comes the makeup, off comes the clown's disguise, the curtains falling, the music softly dies, but I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door, as they say in this biz, that's all there is, there isn't any more.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
Share the moment. And as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new,